interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
We're back. About 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Joe Clancy is going to join us, and I just heard from Tony. As it happens, he's with Maddie, and they're at a doctor's appointment. So Tony begged off. He said, no problem. He said, so maybe tomorrow. It's a quiet weekend, actually. So maybe we'll get Tony so that actually saves us a little bit of confusion. So we'll have room... with Joe Clancy joining us, we'll have room for Seth Merrow and probably Rich Eng. All right? Although something tells me I'm forgetting something. I'm not exactly sure. That was tremendous fun, I got to tell you. I had a feeling it would be fairly rollicking and upbeat, but, you know, it should be taken really as a message. I mean, in a lot of ways, you look at that list, you know, a varied list of, he's got horses with eight different trainers, and now is back up, you know, after buying two dozen at the sale, has upwards of 100 in training, and it's got to make you feel encouraged, I would think. Joe Clancy joins us now, and of course Joe and Tom Law together with us at Pimlico on Friday, and I don't think there's a picture of Joe looking at his phone while the horses were in deep stretch on Saturday. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you? And I have to correct the record. Tom Law was checking his program. Yeah, I swear.
That was very funny because he was looking down. He said he didn't. For people that didn't see this, there's a picture of the viewing stand, and in the back there's Tom Law standing. It looks like he's looking down at his phone, but he's just looking to see who the six was, and he's trying to, because he didn't recognize those pink silks of the Frat Kids. So. as they were flashing by, that picture is funny. Everybody's talking about Steve Asmussen and Michael McCarthy in the center. What people, and I forgot to go back and do this, what people didn't notice, Gary West is in that picture, right behind the guy in the green shirt. And nobody noticed Gary West in there, and Gary was a little crestfallen about how Concert Tour performed. Meanwhile, though, Joe, I think the widespread conclusion was that this was a satisfying result for a lot of good reasons.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the horse delivered. I mean, that's the best thing. I mean, that horse ran that race on that day, you know, and ran down those horses. I mean, he didn't have to. He could have flattened out like we see horses do a lot, but he dug in and came by those horses. Great win to me for a guy, Michael McCarthy, who does a great job, has a relatively small stable. I mean, in today's world, he might not be the first guy people think of, but does a great job, cares about his horses, is humble every time you talk to him. To me, it was pretty satisfying from that. From the industry side, I feel like sometimes if we leave it to the horses, they'll get it right, you know. Like Medina Spirit doesn't know anything about all this, and he ran a great Derby. Ron Bauer doesn't know anything about this, and he ran a great Preakness, you know. So I think if we leave it to them and stay out of their way, they're going to come through for us.
Well, it was 2 days that were just glorious. I mean, in terms of the atmospheric conditions. I mean, granted, he couldn't have a full infield party and the kinds of things that make Preakness unique and special. But there was a solid crowd on hand, and we continue to kind of build the ambient attendance as we move you know, further and further, you know, back toward, you know, back toward a reality that people can enjoy a little bit more actively. So it just it feels like there's some momentum, Joe. You know, even against a tide of you know, difficulties and you know, head shaking frustrations, it as usual, the you know, the outcome on the oval it puts certain things in the background.
Yeah, for sure. And you touched on it there. The days of racing they put together for Friday and Saturday were, you know, were tremendous. And I think for whatever reason, Preakness weekend draws such a cross section of horses. I mean, you've got, you know, California horses, Kentucky horses, New York horses, a big group of Maryland horses, the Fairhill trainers come, you know, it just makes for great racing. I mean, the mix of horses in all those races on both days creates a great card of races either Friday or Saturday. I mean, you wouldn't take anything away from either day, really. And I think that's the fun of it. For me, it's all, you know, it's home, so you have this kind of pride in it too, that Maryland Racing can lure those horses and put together those kinds of races.
Well, and we didn't, you know, we were a little crammed on Friday because we, you know, we had been eclipsed from the Thursday broadcast, so we didn't really get a chance to, you know, celebrate some of that. But as it happens, even with a sidebar of sadness yesterday with Josh Pons joining us to pay tribute to Malibu Moon, I mean, even under that scenario, we were still able kind of to celebrate, you know, the horsemanship, and I don't want to confine it just to Maryland, because Pennsylvania, Delaware, Virginia, you know, the outlying western portion of the Mid-Atlantic, West Virginia. I mean, there's a strong heritage, and Maryland is the bedrock of that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and yeah, sometimes the state borders and the boundaries and the various kind of politics is the wrong word, but the various parts of the Mid-Atlantic get a little lost in it. But to me, yeah, we're all in it together, and the horses routinely run and the trainers support the races at all of those places because they're so close together and accessible and the racing's that good. You know, it's a strength, and it's something to be celebrated for sure, and something to, you know, be proud of and to take part in. And again, it kind of comes to a head at Pimlico on previous weekend.
Well, and just, you know, kind of thumbing through, particularly away from the stakes card, but, you know, I haven't even mentioned some of the, you know, some of the other winners from the 2 days, but, you know, Brittany Russell with that Wonder Where Craig Is in the allowance on Friday, and somebody like Anthony Aguirre, missing the big dog, you know, with the nice price in the allowance mid-card on Friday. You know, you had a bunch of that. Trombetta and Country Life with the big price winner of the nightcap on Friday. That was, you know, that was part of the celebration. You know, there's so much there, you know, on a daily basis. For those that don't watch the region, you know, there's good racing, and you know, it is interchangeable almost. I mean, Colonial coming back with what hope we expect will be a full season this summer, for instance, you know, after last year's abbreviated return. So there's a lot to feel good about. There was the Maryland Equine Center party on Thursday to kick off the new permanent home. I talked about that with Cricket Goodall on Wednesday. I mean, there's just then Timonium. We're going to talk about what went on Monday, Tuesday as well at the sale, the record-breaking sale on Monday and Tuesday.
Yeah, the sale was something. From a selfish point of view, I could use for a little more of a break. But you know, we piled the sale right on top of the Preakness. Yeah, it was amazing to watch. I mean, just the depth and sort of strength of that two-year-old sale when they got horses that sell for $4,000 and horses that sell for $1.5 million, you know, and they blew the gross record out of the water. And, you know, it was just, it's all good signs because that drives the industry. My office here in Fair Hill is literally shares a parking lot with Fasig Tipton, and it's great to see Padgett Bennett and that team come through, you know, with a sale like that. And, you know, I know they've dealt with a lot as well. All those, you know, the consigners and the sales companies have been, you know, last year was just question after question after question, and kind of like the racing, it seems like maybe it's, you know, maybe we are going to get through all this.
Well, and I want you to tell a story. It's so funny. I just had a rollicking 40 minutes plus with Joe Besseker, who was the individual star of the sale, buying 23 head. And I kidded Jessica Martini on Tuesday. I said, you know, for a guy that dispersed, he's sure buying a lot of horses. Well, we got the backstory just now from Joe, but there's even more of a story apparently behind the consigner, that Robert Brewer, who consigned the Gormley that Joe bought for $4.25.
Yeah, and there were a couple like that went for that much money. And the Gormley, we might have our Gormleys mixed up. The other Gormley went for $4.50. Was a Maryland bred that Chris Seal sold. Chris and Margot Seal. That's the story I was chasing down there. But again, there were fireworks everywhere, and it was kind of amazing, really. And again, it goes back to sort of the strength of this. Of the game. I mean, there were so many trainers there and owners there, and I talked to a lot of consigners, obviously, at the sale with interviews and things, and all of them say that the mix of people who come to that sale is what drives it. You know, I mean, it's just, you have obviously the higher end buyers buy at all the sales, you know, and at a sale like Timonium, you've sort of got all the higher end people, and then you've got this sort of influx of trainers from, and their owners, you know, from New York and Pennsylvania and Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, wherever. You know, you're just as likely to stand next to Ron Moquette bidding on a horse as you are, you know, a smaller time steeplechase guy, or, you know, who dabbles in a few 2-year-olds on the side, that kind of thing. I mean, it's wild to watch.
Go ahead and tell the Chris Seal story then about Hip 417.
Yeah, they literally brought one horse to the sale. Chris and his wife Margot Seal and their son Cash. They bought a yearling privately after the sale last year at Timonium for $35,000, and they sold him for $450 at the sale the other day. So again, their one horse consignment had a big day. And he kept using the term, we live in the barn. And, you know, lots of people tell you they live in the barn and they mean they, you know, work in the barn, but no, they actually live in an apartment in the barn. So as he put it, the horses are part of our family, literally. And to come through like that, and, you know, he kind of mixes, he's in Ocala and comes up to Delaware to train a few every year, and you know, probably sells half a dozen to a dozen 2-year-olds every year, you know, and again, as one horse consignment came through big time at Timonium.
That's tremendous. And, you know, you do watch the pinhook, you know, for the pinhook successes, and that's a dream scenario. Wow. I mean, 400.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, basically a $400,000 profit, give or take, on that. You know, and that means, you know, you're speculating on the first crop sire. You're speculating, looking at the horse as a yearling, and you know, the gift that successful young horse buyers have is the, you know, the unique eye to look at a young horse and be able to see what one is going to project to and what it's going to look like. You know, if it's a weanling, you know, being able to see it as a yearling, seeing it as a 2 or 3-year-old, a 2-year-old in the training sale environment, looking at it and seeing it as a 3-year-old or an older horse. I suppose it can be cultivated, Joe, but to some degree, isn't it a little bit of a gift?
Yeah, I would think so. And even anybody with the gift or anybody who's cultivated it will tell you it doesn't always turn out the way you think it's going to turn out. You know, I mean, that's the mystery or the beauty of the game. You know, they're animals. Nature's got a lot to do with it. It changes all the time. I talked to Eddie Woods there that day, who actually sold the top two horses, and then we started talking about Rombauer, who he had, and he said he just wasn't going to be, a really high-end two-year-old. He probably would have, if he took him to Timonium that of his two-year-old year, he says he probably would have bought, he would have worked okay. He probably would have brought 25,000, 30,000. He advised the Fracken to take him and race him and see what happens. Well, they just want to bring this for him. So, I think that's what makes this whole thing go is the animals that nobody, despite years of experience or anything else, nobody is for sure exactly what you're going to get.
Yeah, and there's also, the reality, the risk factor that you're rolling the dice that, what you're investing literally any time could be hurt, and the schedule gets thrown off to the point where they're not going to be ready for a two-year-old in training sale environment at all from February to June, essentially. You got that window between OBS and Phasig for the most part. It's a it's a high wire act, Joe.
For sure. But if it was certain, if you just bred the most expensive stallion to the most expensive mare and got the best horse, it really wouldn't be much fun, would it?
No, exactly. and exactly right. And it's what, it's really what drives, I think, the vast majority of participants, that even includes homebred operations where I'll give you, and I don't know if you wrote about it at the time, when Mrs. De Tomaso was enjoying Irish War Cries run, whenever there was the opportunity to talk about breeding him, she would always point out how she got Curlin before he went to Six Figures, and I always got the biggest kick out of that because certainly she could have covered the mare with Curlin at 150 as easily as at I think 60,000 or even 50 maybe at the time, but she loved the fact that she didn't have to spend a fortune to even to create the baby, let alone buy one on the open market.
Yeah, again, the game, that to me is just whether people are hunting for bargains or they want the to reduce the risk a little bit, even if they can afford the risk. I think that's again, it's just because things there's nothing guaranteed, and you gotta play to whatever works for you and stick to it, and you get rewarded in the long run.
No doubt. A couple of other notes we should include too, because while we were keeping track of things at Pimlico, over at Radnor, you had the racing going over the hurdles, and I just glanced at the results, and did Sean head up to Malvern?
I mean, stayed home on the farm, it looked like, so in Virginia. But the steeplechase schedule has been so upside down or just very different. It's nice to see Radnor, which is a traditional Preakness Day race outside Philadelphia. And they managed to pull it off after, it didn't happen at all last year. Elizabeth Voss won a couple of races. Their barn's been a little quiet, so it's kind of nice to see that. Every division of racing is better if there's a little more depth and things spread around a little bit. So nice to see. There's a good Timber Horse Mystic Strike that he won again, and he'll be headed to the Virginia Gold Cup next weekend. And again, I think everybody on the just like flat racing side, everybody's just appreciative of the opportunity to run. where so much of it was knocked out last year.
Well, and you mentioned Voss in addition. Cyril Murphy for Mr. Naylor won an apprentice hurdle. And I see Todd McKenna. You mentioned Mystic Strike, right? Jack Fisher won a handicap. And Ricky Hendricks as well, a maiden winner. And there you go. There's the that was Radnor on Saturday. And the scene shifts, we should mention, for this week, down to Carolina. You got the Carolina Cup on Saturday.
Yeah, which is typically a late March or early April date. And, again, they tried to push later to in hopes of being able to get a crowd there, and they're going to get a crowd. So it's always a big popular kind of tailgating festival type race meet, and they've got a pretty good card of races too. I mean, there's a nice the kind of $35,000 handicap feature that's got 11 horses in it, you know, which is good to see.
Well, and a quick let's take a quick glance at this, and I haven't looked. I don't know if the PPs are up at DRF yet, you know, one story, and I see Sportswear, Bernie Dalton's going to ride for KMSN. This Kerry Breon story that, you know, from the winter, Joe, that, you know, she took over the Shepherd runners and now is back after the, you know, the jump season ended in the UK. And, you know, she's putting together some partnerships. I mean, she seems like a going concern.
Yeah, and I think she's been a little quiet for the amount of horses she has so far this year. But I think, again, that's just a little bit. They went to Ireland, and, you know, things just our schedule got so where the first month was basically timber races, and she doesn't really have timber horses at the moment, but has stalls at Fair Hill and is, you know, likely to have some decent horses. I mean, owners have supported her. She obviously inherited a few from the Jonathan Shepherd squad, you know, when he announces retirement, but then they've added a few too. So it'll be interesting to see. Again, I think she's probably going to be running more horses as the season gets longer here, as we, you know, and then would be active at Colonial Downs and Saratoga and, you know, probably headed on into the fall too. Was a little quiet probably in April, but we'll have runners coming along now for sure.
I see that Show Court, I thought Arch was retired from riding. Arch is gonna ride some on Saturday.
Yeah, he had a winner a few weeks ago with a horse, the horse Kill Ronan, who's in the same race. I think he kind of Arch does a lot of his own riding in the morning and training with horses, you know. And I think he kind of came to the conclusion that he might as well ride him in the afternoon. And you know. He's got loads of experience and, you know, certainly talented. And Camden's the hometown meet for him. So you got to respect him a little bit. And you know that he's been kind of pointing a lot of these horses for Carolina Cup. So, you know, the guys coming down from Maryland are going to run into some pretty fit horses, I would think, of Arch.
Well, if Arch is going to, you know, start riding regularly again, what we got to get Sean back in the irons.
I'll put my mom on the phone, and she would tell you no. I think Sean would tell you no too. No, more power to Arch. I think it's great. You know, it's amazing to see, really. And when you go back and look at it for as long ago as he was, you know, really active on the circuit, and to get back in the saddle is pretty cool.
It's a nice group. Jack Fisher sends a trio, actually, Sight, Pick'em, and Lord Justice, and for all of his clients too, Mrs. Johnston and Woods Lane and Bruton Street. This is for an early season. You can tell everybody's into the bit to run. It looks like that's pretty nice. Jack's actually got one too in the Camden Plate. Bob LaPenta has crossed over into the jump scene.
Yeah, Fast Car, who was a winner at Saratoga over hurdles last year, yep. Is getting his season started and with a little flat prep. And, you know, he looked like he was, you know, a young horse to kind of watch last year. And he'd be pretty tough if he showed up and, you know, in he's won two over jumps, I guess, now. So he'd be, you know, he'd be eligible for some of those novice races and things like that. And again, we need all the crossover we can get. Stone Farm had a winner at Radnor, so I think that's a good thing. For the more crossover with steeplechasing and flat racing, the better for everybody.
Well, this is a nice card. I printed it this morning, and they're going to have people on hand, right?
Yeah. I think they're pretty excited about it again. When it didn't happen last year, it's a big loss. So I think it's a good thing to see it. You know, even it's a little later. They're usually out of the South by this time of year, but you know, I think racing opportunity matters, and it's good for everybody.
Nice. And then where do we go from here, Joe, actually, schedule-wise?
Virginia Gold Cup, which will be a big stop.
Nice.
That's next Saturday, the 29th. And then there's you'll see a lot of big, you know, a lot of owners want to run there, a lot of trainers want to run there, and the Gold Cup card will be pretty – it'll be pretty deep, I would think.
Excellent. Little Washington, for those that want to make a plan, and in the spring and fall, one of the really nice my friend Skip Moser, his brother, used to cater down there, and we always had a lot of fun. That's a terrific option. You know, I'm constantly trying to encourage people to take it in when it's in their, you know, if it's within their, you know, driving distance. If they have the opportunity, once you go, you're sure to make it a regular, you know, a regular part of your racing attendance. And you know, that pent up, in terms of a pent up demand, Joe, people are just are so eager. That's the one thing. Everybody I ran into in Baltimore Friday and Saturday, that's all they could talk about is, you know, what are things going to be like at Saratoga this summer, and you know, should I book the hotel, should I take a house for the week. You know, everybody's so eager.
Yeah, I mean, and you see that everywhere. I mean, we're revving up our operation with the Saratoga Special, trying to, you know, sell some ads and line up staff and talking to the printer, and they're great things to be talking about, you know. After as just upside down and seat of the pants as you felt last year, you feel like you see things coming, you know. And I don't think anybody wants to come out and say we'll have XYZ in terms of fans or whatever, but I know they're all pretty optimistic, and you know, mostly because nobody wants to have to backpedal. You know, you'd rather just keep expanding it a little bit if we can.
What's going on at This Is Horse Racing? How are you guys shaping up here toward Belmont?
Yeah, we've got plenty to do. We've got Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred deadline coming. We always cover those two previous days really big. Plenty of steeplechase stuff to do. And, you know, there's some horses at Ferial Training Center I need to go watch and spend some time with too. And especially this time of year, it's like the place is full now, and it's full of some really good horses. So just out of, you know, Mean Mary, we saw Caravelle won there. You kind of forget that Mystic Guide is over there. It's an amazing place, and some cool horses to go meet and do some stuff on.
Joe, speaking of which, this training situation in terms of everybody clearing out of Laurel for Timonium, which is going to be actively used for training, what's the parameters of what's going on that front?
It's, you know, I mean, it's unfortunate, and it's kind of a mess, but they're going to find the best solutions. I mean, you know, basically the horses at Laurel, while they're, I think they tried to see if they could redo the track while the horses were there, and it just is going to be faster, better, more efficient if the horses are not there. They can actually do the work and not worry about trying to get horses on the track for galloping or whatever else. So, you know, they're going to fill up Pimlico now that the Preakness is gone and those horses are gone, so there's room there, and they're going to, they're going to use that track at Timonium now that the sale is over, and use that stable area at Timonium to train. You know, Maryland's pretty lucky that it has those couple of options, really. I was at Timonium in 1983, the summer before I went to college with a string of my dad's, and the Timonium had like a full 40-day meet, I think, at that summer. We were running there what felt like every day, you know. And we trained everything from 2-year-olds to steeplechasers around the Timonium track. So it was a great place to be for the summer, and it gets to wake up again, and they get to do it again. You know, so again, they're pretty lucky to have those options. You know, I think some other people went to Delaware, other people went, you know, to send horses to farms. They were scrambling a little bit for stalls. There's a few people at Fairhill who rent stalls to, you know, they own the barn and rent stalls to other people.
Right.
And I think that got pretty busy too. So, it's not ideal, but again, they're lucky to have at least some options like that.
You know, a couple of points on this as well, and the fact that this was going on last week, it explains the reference that I heard from one of the NBC guys that. That they were told the NBC tech staff, they were told, you know, they needed to get the trucks moved as quickly as possible after Saturday. And what was happening on this front in terms of the stabling concerns and needs, that explains, you know, because some people speculated that it would in fact mean that, you know, maybe they were going to start on some of the, you know, some of the demolition and some of the things that are anticipated, you know, with the redevelopment plan. And there was quite a bit written about the redevelopment plan over the weekend, both in the Baltimore Sun and down, you know, in some of the regional periodicals in Anne Arundel and so forth. And this situation explains why NBC was being urged to, you know, pack up the trucks as quickly as possible, because, you know, the need for everybody to move in, you know, to the barn area, that
exactly.
It was going to be.
Yeah,
even,
there were a few kind of rumors around that they were going to start demolition of Pimlico immediately the day after the Preakness, and I was like, no, that's not it.
No. And Joe, you know, I'm going to throw this at you, because I did receive in response, you know, Alan Foreman, who's, you know, contributes on an ongoing basis to the show for years. He's been a regular these last 2 weeks. and every Preakness week for years, we've discussed with him that, you know, the efforts that have resulted in the legislation, and I've seen some really insulting things written and said in certain quarters about what the redevelopment plan, what the expectations are, and what you know, what the value of them would be, and. One of the frustrations in seeing things written and hearing these things is that obviously nobody is the people that are making the kinds of references to the plan obviously haven't either researched or bothered to understand what, you know, how this is being structured, that you know, these are bonds that are being issued and raised, you know, right away the assumption is, oh, the taxpayers are going to be, no, that's not how this is being financed, and so, you know, to me, the critiques, and it's funny, there's no critiques about, and there aren't even people that understand that Laurel's being rebuilt as well, that it's being raised completely and starting from scratch. I like people saying, oh, the money should be spent at Laurel. The money is going to be spent at Laurel as well. It's not just a new, you know, community center and you know, permanent home for the Preakness. What's your take on this, Joe, as a longtime observer and you know, participant and a Marylander?
Yeah, I mean Alan and the attorneys have the details figured out, and I'm amazed that they managed to to do it, the work they did to pull it off was, you know, phenomenal. And basically, it's racing, investing in its own future and its own potential. You know, with again, with money, they're leveraging the money that would be purse money or whatever you want to call it for, and racing development money to once and for all create the facilities that can be what they can be, which to me is then just going to fuel, you know, more of the industry and the growth and all the things people talk about. You know, I mean, some of the only things that maybe held Maryland back a little bit after the slots legislation passed and after the, you know, the slot subsidies went to purses, the only things that held it back was maybe the facilities, you know. So they found a way to use money that was already directed to racing to fund redevelopment of the facilities, you know, which I think is, you know, again, there's a lot of work to be done, but I think it's, you know, it can only mean good things in the long run. And at both facilities, to me, Laurel becomes a much more of a home for horses year round that can train and do more things. Pimlico becomes a racing venue, a world-class racing venue, and an asset to that community, you know, which I think is a win for everybody as well.
No, that's my feeling too, and there's a certain community that that says move the Preakness to Laurel. The Preakness isn't the Preakness at Laurel. I'm sorry. It's just not. And I saw some disparaging, you know, comments about, if this wasn't happening, nobody would invest in the property. Well, actually, Sinai Hospital was salivating to get their hands on the property. So you're wrong. The people are wrong on that front too, because Sinai would love to expand up the hill. I don't understand why anybody would root against it, Joe. That's the part that I find really upsetting, that nobody understands that it could be, you know, like the scene in Star Trek II, where the Genesis effect and it goes from dark to light and generates a rebirth. I mean, Park Heights is trying hard as it is against difficult circumstance. I find it, I love going there, and I say this every year. I mean, in my business career, I sold up and down Reistertown Road, and I'm just rooting for the area.
Exactly. I think we all are.
Exactly. Joe Clancy, everybody, and you can follow Joe, of course, on Twitter. He goes by Joe Clancy on Twitter.
Joe goes Clancy by 65. You got to add the number, because I think you get an Irish attorney if you just do Joe Clancy.
Well, and we know some people that probably need that could use the services of an Irish attorney. You also made me. Now you just made me think too. The horse that I produced that picture, I'm going to put that up today. Did you explain the details about that stake winner?
Yeah, format, which was as close as the Clancy's got to the Preakness. My father trained a mixed stable of steeplechasers and flat horses, and we had a good 2-year-old into a 3-year-old. Format was his name. Was a Maryland bred. He won the Federico Testio in 1984, which was his first start of the year, and when it was at Pimlico, and we were, you know, all excited because the year before, Deputed Testimony had won the Testio and the Preakness, and made it look like it could be done. And we didn't make the Preakness, but it was still a highlight to win the Tessio. And you dug out some nice photos of them that are up there in that Pimlico press box, which is pretty cool.
Well, and that was for George Strawbridge.
Yep. It was a horse my dad had bought. He had bought him at Timonium as a yearling, but it might have been as a 2-year-old. I can't really remember that far. And he won like 4 out of 5 as a 2-year-old, and then won the Tessio back after training here. We trained at Fair Hill and Delaware Park through the winter, and then got to Pimlico. And I guess it would have been April. It was a little farther away from the Preakness, maybe. So it was probably like there would have been another prep in between, maybe. I can't really recall that. You know, again, I was 84. I was a freshman in college, I think.
That's funny. And I just pulled up. The record, and it's FO format. FOUR 4 Matt, number 4 Matt, was a quadratic. Chestnut out of a Swaps mare, and had RNA'd as a yearling at 7,000, and your dad paid 45,000 for him.
There you go. Yeah.
And, as a 2-year-old.
He would have been connected to a friend of his, Vince Mascarelli, I think, was the breeder.
Bronstein, actually. Alf Bronstein.
Oh, Al Bronstein. Okay, so maybe I got that. Yeah, again, we're going back a ways, so it's kind of a... But I think Vince Mascarelli had something to do with that horse anyway. But again, we're going back a long time. He was pretty fast. He created a lot of stress in my dad's life because he was trying to keep him going, you know, and rein him in all the time. And then I remember the stress of Tessio week was Donnie Miller was supposed to ride him, and he took off to ride another horse in a race. So then last minute he got Paul Nicole, and he won, and Donnie Miller was up the track. So, you know.
I love it.
We did a lot of celebrating and jumping around in the winner's circle.
I love it. He had been, he actually had finished his 2-year-old season. He won the Maryland Sales Agency stake to finish his 2-year-old year, then debuted, as you said, in the Tessio and won, but then he never won again.
Yeah, tough. He had a quarter cracks, became kind of a bleeder and dealt with that a lot. Even, you know, that was early days of LASIK
sure.
Things. You couldn't use it at some tracks, you could at others. And he wound up a lead pony with Kevin Martin, Kevin Bowie Martin, who was a jockey, and had a great life.
I love it. Format. I'll put a picture up later, Joe. Joe, this was wonderful. I appreciate it. And who's coming to New York for Belmont coverage?
Tom will be there for sure. And then I'm still trying to figure out what the rest of my spring looks like. So I'm hoping to be there. And, you know, it's always great to get there. It's good for us. It's good. Again, great car to racing. Just trying to fit it in the schedule.
All right. Did you cheer up? Did you cheer up the glum one?
All is good.
All right. People were sending me texts. They're like, I'm worried about Sean. It's like, can I tell you?
I got to a few more Little League games, and everything's good.
Good. All right. lifted the veil of concern. Joe Clancy, everybody, for our thisishorseracing.com visit, and of course the Saratoga special season getting close. In fact, get a hold of Sean and Joe and Tom Law, in position to advertise in the Saratoga special this summer, and get your placement early so that you're part of the special when we come home to the spa. I'm already home, so. I don't have to do anything. I just live here as it is. Joe Clancy, everybody. Joe, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Steve. Talk to you next week.
You got it. Joe Clancy, folks. Let's stay right here, and we got about a half an hour, and trying to scare up Seth Merrow as well. Got to congratulate Seth after, you know, he hit the Indiana pick 5. But standing by, Rich Eng, and we didn't, you know, in all the mayhem of last week, we didn't get to Rich. Rich, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Rich, I got a lot to catch up with you. I mean, we had double indemnity last week because Not only did we have a tech issue in Florida on Thursday, but all the programming was kind of overwhelmed by what was going on. I've seen some of your comments and thoughts, but your observations of what we've seen here in the weeks since Derby.
Well, a lot has changed in the thoroughbred life, especially for Bob Baffert. I mean, we're waiting for the result of the split sample to come back from Kentucky. But I assume the way Baffert and his lawyer made the announcement about the ointment and the potential contamination from the ointment, that I think he expects it to be positive. So if that's the case, that would set off another set of dominoes, so to speak, if it does come back positive. And then I'm sure you spent time talking about the New York Racing Association position on the Baffert horses. So no Baffert horses for the time being in New York. And you would think at the Belmont Stakes, you know, even if he didn't run Medina Spirit or Concert Tour there in the Belmont, he probably had at least a couple of horses for the undercard because there's so many great races on that weekend. But it'll be interesting to see if and when the test comes back. If it is positive, I'll be real interested to see what stance the California Horse Racing Board takes. I'm not going to conjecture because it's all hypothetical, and you know, I don't want to you know, put words or thoughts into somebody's minds. But There's potential for, you know, Baffert to be in some sort of jeopardy as far as some sort of penalty. But it'll be interesting to see. We'll let the due process play out, Steve. But very, very interesting stuff. And then you add on top of that the ruling on Linda Rice. I was really floored to see the harshness of the penalty. But I'm not there, and you know, maybe I didn't understand the entire case that was against Linda. But that seemed awful harsh penalty from my point of view.
Well, it's interesting. That's interesting because, you know, certainly you're out. You know, you had plenty of time on the East Coast, but you know, that's an interesting perspective because there's people who felt that she should be happy that it wasn't 5 or 10 years. And I mean, it's such a unique circumstance that and unusual and given. You know, given the severity of the penalties for the others that were, you know, more immediately sanctioned, whether it was Clocker Steve or Mike Gonzalez or the guys in the racing office that were disciplined, it did seem like she was when everything, all the dust settled and everything was finalized. It did feel like she was going to face a serious repercussion, and I, I kind of mentally was thinking, 18 months maybe. That was sort of the number that I kind of bandied in my head, and I talked to some other trainers, and some of them said, 5 years. Why shouldn't she get, you know, what they gave Dutrow and so forth? They discussed that the other day with as well with. With Alan Foreman, it's a weird situation, it absolutely was deserving of a substantial penalty. There's no questioning that part of it.
Well, I know some of the coverage that I've been following. I guess she had created the kind of an uneven, unlevel playing field in her advantage. And in that way, that affects a lot of the other trainers because they're at a disadvantage if she was garnering and getting information that was useful and helpful for, you know, where she ran and who she ran and stuff like that, you know, to take purse money away from the other trainers and the other owners. So I can understand that because you have to keep the integrity of the sport, number one. It's paramount for not only the horsemen, the owners, the jockeys, but us handicappers and horse players too.
Well, and a couple of things, you know, you mentioned back to the Baffert side of things regarding New York, and one of the things that had been we had kind of heard bits and pieces, but it was confirmed yesterday, Dave Grenig writing that Charlatan, who could have been possible for the Met Mile, he had a setback, and so he was not going to run anyway, as it turns out, and we'll see about whether, you know, whether there's any future at this point. We'll see. It's too late, obviously, way too late for anything regarding
you know, that's another 1-2 punch, Steve, yeah. Because the news on Charlatan, but a couple of weeks ago we heard the news about the Cezanne, who ran an unbelievable comeback race in the Kona Gold, and this literally ran off the television screen with a huge buyer number, and he's sidelined. And so you get these two brilliant horses for Baffert now on the sidelines. They're on the shelf.
Well, since we're doing some breaking news or some news that came to pass in the last few days, just this morning, a decision on the announcer's booth in Tampa, and Jason Bean is going to take over the mic from Richard Grunder, and Grunder's long, wonderful career at Tampa, which ended day after Derby, and it didn't take them really long to make this decision, and certainly it was a job. It's funny, I happen to have just inadvertently talked to several announcers in the past few weeks, and this was a job based on its position in the winter that a lot of people were interested in, that it, you know, it was complementary to the schedule that they currently call, and that's also true though for Jason. So a nice winter gig for Jason Beam. Congratulations to Jason, who's back in the Northwest right now for the Grants Pass season, and getting ready to come back back to the East for the Colonial.
That's fantastic news for Jason, and congratulations. He had some stints kind of sitting in for some other announcers, and, you know, he was one of those guys who was just kind of knocking on the door, and he needed a domino to fall, so the door went open for him, and that is a terrific meet to call. Tampa's come a long ways over the years under Stella Theater. Showing my age, and Steve, is, I remember the George Steinbrenner days when he owned the racetrack down there on the west coast of Florida. But, you know, Richard Grunder, I must admit, I've never had the chance to meet him, but everybody that I've talked to that has met him say that he is one of the nicest people you will ever meet, not just in horse racing, but, you know, in any walk of life. And I remember getting fooled, where this is early on, where someone made a comment that, Richard Grunder's voice was used in the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons. And I went for it hook, line, and sinker, Steve. But obviously it is not true. But his voice, if you've ever followed that cartoon, there is a character who sounds exactly like Richard Grunder on the mic.
That's funny. The delivery and, you know, some of the mannerisms and voicerisms that just endeared him to players and fans. It was just, you know, it just so synonymous with Tampa. I mean, you just knew. And it's funny because there's just been this rash of long-standing voices that 1, 2, 3, you know, have retired, and, you know, it takes some getting used to. We certainly, Keith Jones, I mean, Keith Jones's voice in Philly, and Chris Griffin, you know, not just doing a great job filling in, but he's also, you know, doing some more things and doing some on-air handicapping and interaction, and of course the Let's Go Racing show. And so, you know, Chris has kind of jumped in with both feet in Philly. now, you know, Grunder and there's just been, there's certain voices and sound, familiar sound that you become accustomed to. And, the things that made you smile. I mean, the last horse away from Grunder, just, somebody should, has anybody named a horse, last horse away?
there's a lot to be said about what you're talking about, where if you close your eyes and listen to an announcer, just listen to a little bit of a race call, you know exactly where you are, what track it is, the race. And I know in current days, Dave Rodman has been at the Maryland Jockey Club for many decades now. He was at Louisiana Downs before that. But when I worked at Turfway Park, Mike Battaglia was our announcer, and he called the races at Churchill Downs also, as well as Turfway Park. And I know a lot of people outside of Kentucky, for whatever reason, did not like Mike Battaglia's style. But I would tell them, if you're in Kentucky, Mike Battaglia is like a god. You don't mess with God. And he was, he had a sing-song style that was, very unique. And then even go to Chicago, where you had Phil Georgieff. I mean, announcers like this, there is a flavor, a richness to these gentlemen and the way they call races that, they all don't have to sound like Vin Scully. They represent their part of the country, their niche, part of the racing world, and it's a pleasure to listen to these gentlemen over the years.
Well, and John Curran is another one. I've mentioned Keith Jones and Richard Grunder, but John Curran. I mean, when Delaware gets started, Josh Brown taking over, and so that's going to be a new voice. I mean, Curran. How long was Curran at Delaware?
About easily
decades,
easily 3 decades, maybe 4 decades.
Yeah. And you know who, speaking of this topic, one thing that I thought was really, really nice coming out of Preakness, the conversation that a lot of people, I saw this from more than one observer, people appreciating Dave Rodman talking about, long-term voices at a racetrack. Of course, the Maryland circuit for an MJC, calls. Dave Rodman is somebody that people were really kind about, acknowledging how good Dave is. And he's got a very distinct cadence that it's kind of an old-school cadence, in fact.
And when you come to the top of the stretch, especially now at Pimlico, when you hear him say a quarter to go at Pimlico, you know it's Dave, and you know where you are.
I love it. Who else? You mentioned Georgieff, which it's funny. Georgieff kind of predates me in terms of the circuit, in terms of what I watched. And so I mean, I've certainly heard plenty of his calls, but I don't have that, that distinct recollection of Georgieff in his prime, on the Florida side of things.
Well, one of the terms that Phil Georgieff incorporated in his calls was spinning out of the turn.
Yes,
and I remember
yes.
people asked me, what does that mean, for a thoroughbred race? But people forget that he actually had a strong harness announcing background, and it was spinning out of the turn because of the sulky. And he just brought the term over to thoroughbreds, even though thoroughbreds do not spin out of the turn, but it was still a signature phrase that he would use every time at the top of the stretch. But, there's a story that, maybe John Embriel would not like to bring up, but if you remember in history, folks, there was a year where Phil Georgieff was replaced in the announcer's booth at Arlington Park by a very young John Embriel. And John was not treated kindly in Chicago during that summer. And, it was really unfair because obviously John is an outstanding caller. But for whatever reason, the owners at the time of Arlington Park decided to make a switch from Phil Georgieff to another announcer. And they selected John out of New York. And that lasted one season, and because of the fan fervor, they brought George F. back. But, you know, certainly nothing to do with John's work. He's an outstanding announcer, and he's getting his chance to show it on a daily basis right now. But that's just a little mark in history of how popular an announcer can be in their marketplace, where you try to change the voice, and people don't like it.
Well, and Chicagoland certainly famous, right? Harry Carey had a back and forth, right? Had been with the White Sox, right? And then was brought back later. You know, the Cubs jumped on the opportunity to, and then became, you know, just he was already a legend, but the people probably don't need. There's probably people of a certain age that don't even know that that he called White Sox and St. Louis Cardinal games.
Yeah, and before that, he was a longtime announcer of the St. Louis Cardinals, as you said before. Yeah. Before Jack Buck took over, but Harry's signature is certainly the Chicago Cubs baseball in the daytime.
Yeah, by the way, before we wrap, speaking of baseball, I've never seen anything like this with these no-hitters. I almost put up a thread today on I ended up doing an easygoer Sunday silence stuff, but I almost put one up and said, breaking, over-under for no-hitters today, a half. It's crazy. I've never seen anything like this.
Well, we've got a long ways to go in the baseball season. It's only the middle of May. And, you know, one thing that people are discussing about baseball nowadays is they're really not discussing the pace of play, because that seems to be on the Commissioner Manfred's mind, is pace of play. But I think a bigger problem is the swing and miss style of hitting. Basically, either you hit a home run or you strike out. And since so many guys are swinging and missing, well, it's conducive to these no-hitters, because so many guys are striking out, Steve. They're not putting the ball in play. And, you know, because when you put the ball in play, it's like the old Wee Willie Keeler comment of, you hit them where they ain't. You know, some of them are going to drop in because there's not a fielder there. But when so many guys are striking out, I think you're laying the groundwork for potentially more no-hitters.
Well, it's crazy. I've even seen I think I saw they're talking about lowering the mound or moving it back a couple of feet, and the pitching dominance right now is the watchword. I don't ever remember. I mean, it's May 15th, or whatever, May 20th, and there's been six no hitters. In the first,
that's remarkable.
Yeah, 6 weeks.
Absolutely remarkable.
Crazy. Just crazy.
You know what I think is going to be necessary to make a change as far as hitting? It's going to take like another Billy Beane movement, Moneyball style, to find out that guys who hit 300 are undervalued. And if you maybe put together a lineup of 300 hitters who are more contact hitters and get them at lower salaries than somebody who hits 30 home runs, then you might find a movement back toward making contact with the baseball instead of trying to hit it 500 feet.
Yeah, you would think with all the analytics and the launch angle and the contact and the percentages and the ground ball percentage and fly ball percentage and holy shit, the line drive percentage. I mean, I've been involved in a fantasy league since the mid '80s. I mean, we started in '84. With one league and 85 with another one, and it's got to be one of the longest running of its kind. And I take advantage of one of the stat sites that Baseball HQ, and I mean I can't even keep track of all the of all the creation of these statistics that have been created. I mean, this all goes back to Bill James and the sabermetrics, but it's kind of overwhelming at this point. I mean, the exit velocity, and oh my God, I mean, honestly,
That's a great term, exit velocity. But, you know, when I'm watching these baseball games, like I get to watch the Angels and the Padres out here in the Las Vegas market. The Dodgers are blacked out, of course, Steve. They don't let us watch Dodgers games. But when I see these managers doing the defensive shifts and you get, like, all the infielders on one side of the field, I'm thinking to myself, why the heck don't more of these guys kind of just, if they slap the ball the other way, they got to stand up double. I mean, you know, and then maybe it's a macho thing where they want to hit the ball 500 feet instead of hitting a double. But there's so much space, there's so many opportunities to actually generate offense that are not being utilized.
Well, nobody can bunt and nobody can sacrifice, so you're asking them to go the other way. Forget it. It's those basics. That's how I made the only sport that I could play. I was not blessed with a lot of athletic talent, but I could play baseball because there were certain tricks to it that you didn't have to be the greatest athlete. There were ways to make yourself useful.
Yeah, you're right about baseball. You don't have to be 7 feet tall. And you don't have to weigh 280 pounds.
Exactly.
You can be a normal-sized person to be a good baseball player.
You don't even have to run fast. I mean, you know, some of the best base stealers aren't even guys that are particularly fast. I mean, you just there's certain skills that can be perfected in baseball. That's one of its endearing traits. I mean, frankly, that a guy like me was actually pretty good. So, as a second baseman,
you must have had good hands, meaning you were a good defensive fielder.
I could drop a bunt and I could move runners and things like that. I was the kind of guy you put. Bat second, you could bat me second, or you could bat me seventh, and I would be useful and productive. I would have had some of those good stats actually that the statistics keep track of because I loved it too. I love baseball.
We'd be calling you Wee Willie Bick.
Yes, there you go. Hit them where they ain't. Exactly. Rich, I got Seth coming up, but let me see. You got to play at all today? Did you look at anything?
Yeah, let me give a couple picks real quick. It's been a few weeks, and I think I had one out of two the last time I was.
Yeah,
on,
you did. Yes, you did.
Let's go to Belmont Park for a couple of horses.
Right.
Race number four is 6.5 furlongs, claiming 40. We'll go with the number 7, True Castle. I really like to bet horses coming out of the Oaklawn meet. I really think the quality of animal that was at Oaklawn Park is going to hold up really well wherever they ship to after the meet ends. And here's Steve Asmussen with Luis Saez riding. So I'm going to try that as my first pick, True Castle, the 7 horse in the 4th race.
Nice.
And then let's go to race number 8. It is a turf sprint. This is a turf-only pick. But here's another horse shipping in from another market, and it's the number 3, Ghoul. Peter Miller has now established a shop. I know Vladimir Saran has also set up a small stable, but Peter Miller too. So he's got the number 3 Ghoul coming in from Santa Anita, fast-closing turf sprinter, Joel Rosario up. So we'll go with the number 3 Ghoul in race 8. It's my second pick.
I like it. And, you know, Shecky Shabazz comes back in there for Clement and, you know, off the layoff. So it might be a little, you know, 2-1. So you might get a decent... That 7-2 might hold on Ghoul. Good job, Rich. I appreciate it. Good to catch up, and we'll start to arc next week. We'll be looking toward Belmont, and I appreciate it.
He sounds good, Steve. Good luck, everybody.
Rich Eng, folks. Rich Eng for Pro Pick on Twitter, and of course, the author of Betting on Horse Racing for Dummies. And actually, Rich visits with Seth Merrow, and Seth is standing by. Seth must have been luxuriating this morning. Maybe a little spa treatment, with some of his winnings off of yesterday's brilliant Indiana Grand Pick 5. A ticket handed out, and a value play at just a standing O for Seth Merrow. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun. I tweeted back to Indiana Grand at the end of the day. Fun afternoon / early evening. Tweeted out the ticket. I heard you talking about on the radio show in the morning. So as soon as I got in and did TV, I alerted people that the carryover was coming up, and I thought, well, I'll put a little ticket out there and tweet it out and talk about it as the afternoon progresses. And I went, what was that? I was 4x3 by, and then I singled that the horse still looked good in one of the stakes races. And then 3x4. So 4x3 by 3x4, essentially. So it was a $72 ticket and $1,300. Although people were tweeting at me and somebody said, you know, I thought after you got past the third leg, you were in good shape. And I said, yeah, I did too. I thought once I got past that signal, I was single, I was 3x4. But the last race, I had to sweat out that last race because I did not have the horse that took the big lead in the stretch. And at that point, I thought it was all over. But then one of mine came late and just got up at the wire. Best part about it, it was the longest price of the four horses I had in the mix in that last race. So it all worked out well.
Well, and I picked Roland with Olin. I was all over that six, and I had gotten knocked out in the eighth race, and so I bet the six, who was a square price, and I saw that horse come in that alfalfa, and then I had to acknowledge, you know, that it's our friends, Avi and Rhoda Friedberg, that on Everything's Cricket, New York bred, pretty funny. And nice number, 1,306, and that was with the heavy favorite that won the stake, that won one of the two stakes. You know, that the horse that won the second stake, Seth, was not, I mean, depending on your budget, that was a little bit of a tricky inclusion to be, I thought, anyway. That was Sky Judge.
Oh, yeah, I looked at a lot of tickets. Not a lot. I looked at some of the other tickets that were floating around out there, and that was one that kind of escaped. But I'll tell you that my ticket was probably one more horse than I felt comfortable with. My comfort zone is just a little less than that. But I had the single in the mix, and it was one of those. I went back and forth, and I debated, who do I leave out? Who do I leave out? And then it just got to the point of the horse I leave out will be a winner, and I'll just kick myself. So I did jump in. So, yeah, there were a couple of races where I was a little deeper than I might have liked, and I'm just pulling it up. Yeah, the Sky Judge was 12-1 on the morning line, coming out of a decent little state bred allowance, though, where the horse ran second. And the numbers were kind of pretty comparable with the field in there. But actually, after scratches, that one moved up to second for me. I had sudden shift on top and then went to Sky Judge right underneath. So I had it fairly high up in the mix after a scratch. The six had scratched out, who was clearly a player in that race, Dillsborough Devil.
Yeah.
But I had the horse in the mix. But, yeah, it was 12-1 on the morning line, so it was a little bit of a pull, I guess.
You mentioned where the winner came from, and there's a couple of things. I made a note after opening night on Tuesday. Where is it? Where did I write this down? Holy cow! There it is. It's on the Tuesday sheet. There's been 18 races in 2 days at Canterbury. There have been winners from 9 different last start venues. and here's how far flung they are. One each from Delta, Sam Houston, Canterbury last year, the end of the season, a Santa Anita starter yesterday, Fairgrounds, Hawthorne. And there's been 5 from Tampa and 5 from Oaklawn and 2 from Turf Paradise. 9 different last out venues in 18 races.
Yeah, some meets are like that in that they draw horses from all over. And so it's interesting to kind of keep track of something like that early in a meet and see if you can get a pattern where some of the horses coming in from a certain jurisdiction maybe or have a little edge. I just like overall, you mentioned a number of Oaklawn starters. I talk about it all the time. I like the Oaklawn shippers. For about a month and a half, 2 months after the Oaklawn meet ends, as they go and make their first start at another venue. And it's playing out again this year at you know, various tracks, Churchill and up in New York and whatnot. The Oaklawn Runners have been doing very well again this year.
Some weekend thoughts. You and I were on TV. You had me Sunday as we were making our way back from Baltimore, and I heard, you know, little bits and pieces from you know, introductions of the conversation with you, but your Preakness takeaways.
Well, obviously no chance at a Triple Crown, but it was a nice run by Rombauer. I did not use Rombauer, but I was doing a bankroll promotion at the OTB racebook down in Albany. And when it got to that race, I tossed him in a triple box. I just thought, you know, there's a lot of speed, and that horse and risk-taking, I thought, and they may be the ones that'll pick up the pieces. So I threw him in the mix. So he wasn't, like I said, I didn't have him in my original thoughts, but he wasn't a shock, obviously. And it was a nice run. And so it makes for, I think, an interesting Belmont Stakes. We'll see how it shakes out. I was hoping the filly would go. That would have made it a lot of fun. But she's going to head up to Saratoga, so we'll look for her up there. But I think it's going to be fun at Belmont. It'll certainly be another fun weekend. And overall, we've had two of those now. I mean, the Baffert news took a little of the air out of the balloon in between the two weekends. But, boy, you look at the two weekends of racing down at Churchill with Oaks and Derby, and then this past weekend at Pimlico with Black Eyed Susan and Preakness. Really two nice weekends of racing on the stakes side. And this past weekend, besides the Preakness, I thought you got to watch out for Mighty Mischief coming from the same, you know, trainer owner team as Matoli, who won the Chick Lang and went on to win the Breeders' Cup Sprint eventually. And so Mighty Mischief, I think, is going to be a nice player. Spice is Nice is one of those that was kind of hinting at some talent, and I thought she kind of broke through this weekend. So there were some nice undercard stakes that clearly, like Derby weekend, will play into the various divisions as the year goes along.
You got a play for today? Of course, we've got some Twilight action that'll be on, for those of you watching Fox. Belmont starts at 3:05, and then Churchill has got the Thursday night action, starts at 5 o'clock. What do you got?
Yeah, I head in at OTB Live at 3. The last few Thursdays we've been doing that with the Twilight. Go to from 3 to about 7, Belmont, Churchill. And I was looking while I was waiting to get on the air. I don't have anything clever. My clever Belmont picks were on the weekend. But I will say, if you're playing picks late on the Belmont card in the 8th race, I have it 8, 4, and 6. And so, again, I'm kind of master of the obvious there. Shecky Shabazz hasn't been seen since last year, though, so maybe there's some vulnerability. And the horse I would definitely include, and that's why I'm bringing it up, my man Mike Deeney, comes up to New York. Not as potent in New York as Tampa. He was certainly light back on fire over at Monmouth, though. But I thought Quarky at 6-1 was a player in there. And as I say, if I had a pick ticket, I'd definitely put Quarky in the mix.
At Churchill later tonight, 8 o'clock almost, 7:54, Dean Wilkes has got the 8-5 favorite, but I think I like the other Wilkes, the 5, Fabricate, maybe. And certainly she's going to be a price. That's a good race, three-quarters second-level allowance for fillies. Seth Merrow, everybody. The face of GoTB and basking in the afterglow of a $1,300 score. Well done.
All right. Good luck to everybody this afternoon.
Thanks to Seth and Rich Ang, Joe Clancy, and earlier Dick Powell. And then if you missed Joe Besseker, you will really enjoy him on the archive or the podcast or on the replay tomorrow, 6-9. He was tremendous fun. And I'll put up the contest, and you can name a couple of his horses that he bought this week. Good luck, everybody. Got picks from Gus up at the website for Churchill.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6888.